from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Thousands of women and their supporters gathered in Bay Area cities on Saturday, joining millions of others in cities around the world to protest the inauguration of President Donald Trump. And President Trump's team used its first news conference on Saturday to blast the press, with press spokesman Sean Spicer making several blatantly false statements about the size of the crowd at the inauguration.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
Coming up on Forum, we'll talk protests, politics, and the opening days of the Trump administration. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Massive, peaceful women's marches were held on Saturday in Oakland, San Francisco, and other cities in the Bay Area and around the world. Here's a demonstrator in San Jose.
Equal pay and women's maternity leave is still a huge problem that we're still fighting for, and I think under Trump presidency, that's going to be much harder to fight for.
On Trump's first full day in office, Trump spokesman Sean Spicer used his first news conference to slam the media and make several blatantly false claims on the size of the inauguration crowd. Trump aide Kellyanne Conway made more headlines yesterday when she defended Spicer's remarks on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that.
Conway also confirmed that Trump would not release his tax returns at all, despite promises that he would. In this hour, we look back at the weekend's news and ahead to the first 100 days of President Trump. Joining us from Washington is Greg Gordon. He's an investigative reporter with McClatchy News, co-authored a breaking story on the news about the FBI probe into the Kremlin's possible ties with Trump and the election. And welcome, Greg Gordon.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Domenico Montaro, who is the lead editor for Politics and Digital Audience, NPR. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And let me begin with you just by sort of getting an assessment from your chair, your perspective of what kind of impact the protests had, if any, on the Trump administration. What can we expect, particularly when many feel that there's really a new movement out there, maybe the biggest since the Vietnam War?
I think it's critically important for a lot of people who are against the Trump administration to feel like that there's some sense of solidarity, that there are others who feel the same way and that they are ready to resist, as they put it. I think that for a lot of folks who were not in favor of Trump, they feel that the election was unfair and unjust, given that Hillary Clinton had won almost 3 million more votes than Donald Trump did. Of course, that didn't work out in the Electoral College in the way that they would have liked. And I think that's part of the problem in how the country is sorted. You know, you have a strong group of Democrats in mostly urban areas, and you have Republicans centered in rural and suburban areas. And it's a hugely stark divide. And Donald Trump and the views of Donald Trump can really be separated along the lines of how he's viewed and almost place more than anything else. And I think that there's going to be a lot to see if any of this is going to work for those who are opposed to Trump. You know, with those 2018 midterms being the first place, Democrats have lost more than 1,000 legislative seats during the years of President Obama. Whether or not they can get back any of those seats starting from the ground up is going to be a major test in a couple of years.
Well, it seemed to come down, at least from President Trump's perch, to what the crowd size was. I mean, I'm sorry to put it so bluntly, but, you know, there was a lot of concern about also the intelligence agencies, and that came out over the weekend. He addressed them and he spoke to them very positively, but that was after calling them Nazis. I mean, we do have a little bit of chaos here, really, even before we've even got underway, although today it seems he's governing or at least signing executive orders.
Yeah, and he's certainly signed some policy initiatives since he started. I mean, he had his first executive order on the night of the inauguration to, quote, ease the burdens of Obamacare, and seems to be targeting the mandate, although it's unclear exactly what it would do. It's not quite clear just yet. I think it does throw a lot of confusion into the system. And if you're somebody who has health insurance through Obamacare, and you must be wondering, you know, should I buy insurance? Will it be enforced? What if I get a bill from the IRS? Is that enforceable? He's this morning vowed to renegotiate TPP. He's issued a federal hiring freeze and is going to reinstate the Mexico City policy, apparently, which is essentially saying that you can't give funding through USAID to foreign groups or that do family planning if they, through their private funds, perform abortion services. So clearly, there is a direction that already the Trump administration wants to go, even though, yes, it was a chaotic weekend. I mean, there is no such thing as alternative facts, but clearly the size of the crowd got under the skin of the administration and were trying to push back any way they could.
We also ought to mention, it hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but there's an overturn already of the mortgage fee reduction that was geared for low-income first-time homebuyers.
That's absolutely true. And you know, so you see an activist presidency beginning immediately. It's one of those things that, you know, during the campaign, one of the problems Hillary Clinton wound up having was that a lot of young voters went third party. And in some states, that could have made a big difference. And one of the arguments I kept hearing from a lot of folks was, well, there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans. You know, they all take money. They're all kind of the same politically. And I kept saying, you know, look, I don't really, it's not my job to tell you how to vote or who to vote for, but there's factually, objectively, a difference in the direction that Republicans and Democrats would want to take the country.
Domenico Montanaro with us from Washington, lead editor for Politics and Digital Audience for National Public Radio. We're also going to talk to Greg Gordon about what we've learned vis-a-vis the Kremlin and Russian interference and hacking and the like. But I want to go first to Rebecca Cinderbrand, who's joining us from Washington, also political editor of The Washington Post. And Rebecca, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I guess I'd like to have you sort of explain from your perspective, since you've written about it, this strange dichotomy that we saw over the weekend with Kellyanne Conway. I think you called it ushering in an era of alternative facts. Alternative facts, which, as Chuck Todd said, really maybe are just lies or mendacity.
Well, and we're also getting a lot of one of the issues that the press is having with this White House. And we have to mention, of course, that Sean Spicer's the White House press secretary is going to be getting his first questions from the press as White House press secretary in just a little bit. They seem to be putting out messages that are in direct conflict with each other, very aggressive messages that push back on factual reporting that the press has done. And so people are really kind of reconfiguring the way that they report on the White House. It's a very different White House than we've ever covered before.
What about Kellyanne Conway's argument, which she presented to Chuck Todd, that the press and the media aren't covering things that are really of more central importance? I mean, one might say the same, of course, about the Trump administration dwelling or focusing on crowd sizes and the like. But she cited President Trump meeting with, for example, Benjamin Netanyahu, and meeting also with Theresa May, the Prime Minister of England, and the head of Israel, but also, you know, negotiating trade deals. In other words, is the president maybe not getting the attention that he deserves with respect to those kinds of issues because other things are overshadowing?
Well, one thing we should point out, of course, is that some of this emphasis, a large part of this emphasis, comes from the top. The president himself, he has the largest bully pulpit on the planet. And whatever he chooses to focus on, almost by necessity, consumes a lion's share of the attention. And Donald Trump is not focused on policy. He, of course, is engaged in policy, but that's not his main focus at this moment. Over the weekend, it seemed to be the framing, pushing back on the press, kind of setting the narrative for the presidency in that respect. But when it comes to policy as well, it seems as though, even though there's this list of objectives, and obviously they're moving very quickly and they want to give the impression of moving very quickly on a laundry list of issues, it's still very difficult to get details beforehand or to get many kind of fleshed out details of precisely what they're planning. Now, perhaps this is because they're keeping it very close to the vest. Perhaps it's because they themselves have not come through with those details and figured out that roadmap as yet. But when you have kind of these very vague bullets when it comes to policy, but a very fleshed out, impassioned argument on everything else, and it's coming from the top, from the commander in chief, that's where the spotlight is going to fall.
Well, there's also a lot of spotlight today, and I want to get your response to this, because a number of prominent scholars, constitutional scholars, Supreme Court legislators, and former White House ethics lawyers have expressed the intention to file a lawsuit today. And it's about emoluments again. This has come up in the news before. President Trump, they allege, is violating the Constitution by allowing his hotels and other business operations to accept payments from foreign governments. So, does this have any legs, do you think?
Well, so certainly President Trump says this is not his pushing back. He just now in the White House told reporters that the suit has absolutely no merit. We're going to have to see. This is not an issue that's going to go away. Certainly, no matter what happens with this particular suit, people are going to continue to bring those sorts of suits and to raise those sorts of complaints. You're going to continue to see. You're going to see legislation. You're going to see all sorts of movement on this over the entirety of the Trump presidency, whether that's 4 years or 8 years. He, based on the plan that he has laid out for himself when it comes to how he treats his business, and of course, his staff today is saying that he has now officially kind of divorced himself from the business. It doesn't completely do that. No matter what he does at this point, we know that he is going to remain connected in some respect, whether or not he's involved in day-to-day operations. And because of that, this issue will not disappear, no matter how much the White House would like it to.
Rebecca Sender-Brown with us from Washington, again, political editor of The Washington Post. One of the other things that's clearly probably won't disappear is the concern about the Russian involvement in the election and ongoing concern about ties perhaps between President Trump and not only Vladimir Putin, but Russia itself. Greg Gordon, again, is investigative reporter of the McClatchy News, and he co-authored a breaking story on the news about the FBI probe into the Kremlin's possible ties with Trump in the election, which Greg Gordon, President Trump, was calling a witch hunt and comparing to Nazis. And then he met with the CIA, and it was, at least from his point of view, I guess, a love fest.
Well, he's bobbing and weaving around the intelligence agencies because obviously there's been a lot of friction since they presented him first with a report. Well, they didn't present it solely to him, but they made public a report, declassified version of a report that asserted that Vladimir Putin ordered the hacking, ordered an intervention in the United States general election. And then came the face-to-face meeting in which the new president learned that Russia may have information, what they refer to as compromat or compromising information about him. And so this was pretty unsettling, I'm sure, for Trump to receive as he just gets ready to take the throne. But then on top of that, we have the ongoing investigation, which Peter Stone and I wrote about, and I know the Post had a story about, and the New York Times had a story about last week. And we felt it was a good idea to get the story out and get it out for the record that some of the areas in which a working group of, depending upon who you talk to, as many as six law enforcement and intelligence agencies led by the FBI is exploring related to Russian influence. And so now we have Trump taking office and his agencies, his CIA, his National Security Agency, FBI, and the FinCEN unit of the Treasury Department, which looks into financial crimes and money laundering, are supposed to be investigating, whether or not Russia helped him get elected. And so how his new attorney general to be, and other heads of chiefs of these agencies proceed will be most interesting to see, because they're inheriting an extremely sensitive investigation.
Well, especially about the financing of the hacking, going back to John Podesta's email, but also so allegedly paying email hackers to Russian pensioners and all of these kinds of things that have surfaced. I want to find out from you, though, Greg Gordon, what we really know at this point. I mean, there's been a good talk about business relationships with Russian business people and Kremlin ties, good talk about Russia not only funneling funds into the U.S. election, but actually, as you said, influencing it to a great degree. And a lot of this remains sort of, from the perspective at least of the Trump administration, not proven. I mean, he threw out, you know, the Iraq war and weapons of mass destruction, which was also from our intelligence sources.
That's exactly right, Michael. And I know the Washington Post, New York Times, and it seemed like any large news agency in town were trying to corroborate was this fascinating 35-page document that was assembled by a former British intelligence officer who was under contract. Let's be sure to say this. He was under contract with a consulting firm in Washington that had clients that were first Republican and then Democratic individuals or entities that wanted to see what they could, what kind of information they could excavate about Trump's relationship with Russia. And so this intelligence agent, who has a very good record, is apparently now in hiding, had a network of sources inside the Kremlin that he developed while he was working for MI6, the British intelligence agency. And the problem is, the Russians are very good, and all through the document it says they're going to do this and that to make sure they have plausible deniability. So the dossier, as this 35-page document has come to be known, lays out some fascinating stuff, almost none of which has been verified yet. That's not to say people aren't trying, and we're told the working group is still trying to verify certain things. There are three Trump aides or employees with his campaign and his business organization who were named in this document, including his former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, whom the New York Times says was a subject of a wiretap under the auspices of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court.
Well, Manafort was on the payroll of Ukraine, but you know, how much does that go to Russia and the Kremlin?
Well, it doesn't necessarily. But if this dossier, for example, if this dossier were accurate on this point, that would implicate the Trump campaign at least to the extent of knowing that the Russians were hacking. If they did anything, if they took any kind of anybody in the Trump campaign took some action to further such a scheme, then we might be talking about participating in a criminal conspiracy.
Again, we're talking
about right now, it's all unproven. You're absolutely right. The one thing that was really intriguing to us was to learn that this dossier didn't start the investigation. The investigation was triggered by other leads last spring, about a month or two before this dossier appeared, before this British intelligence agent contacted the FBI, because he felt that this stuff went beyond just, opposition research, but actually went to something much, much more serious.
Again, we're talking to Greg Gordon, investigative reporter from McClatchy News, and the FBI and five other law enforcement and intelligence agencies continue the probing of covert Kremlin aid to the Trump campaign. But, of course, as Greg Gordon said, the sands are shifting in terms of who's going to be in different positions in all those areas. Let me go back, if I may, Domenico Montanaro, to you, and get your take on the Trump. I want to find out what you think about the Trump website, which has gone up and which has certainly created a good deal of consternation and responsiveness. Give us some highlights.
Well, we know the Trump administration has now issued basically six priority positions. None of them actually, by the way, include health care, which was kind of interesting given the campaign against Obamacare. But it has six sections. One, it says America First Energy Plan, foreign policy, bringing back jobs and growth, making our military strong, standing up for law enforcement community, and trade deals working for all Americans. So and notice in all of that the controversial use of the phrase America First, which has a history in this country. The Anti-Defamation League had told Trump during the campaign not to use it because it was an anti-Semitic slogan that had been used before World War II as a way not to get into World War II. But Trump believes in the way that he can rebrand things, that he can rebrand this as what's the problem? America and First. So that's the way he thinks. So part of that was you started to get a look at what may be a Trump doctrine, a Trump foreign policy doctrine, because he posted 3 points within that: defeating ISIS, rebuild the military, and embrace diplomacy. And one of the lines within that was, we are always happy when old enemies become friends.
Yeah, it does sound like Russia, doesn't it?
Certainly does. And one of the other lines in there that has some allies a little queasy is saying that old friends would become allies. And certainly that could be seen as taking aim at a country like Japan or South Korea or most of those NATO countries who have not wanted to feel like the U.S. was rejiggering its relationship or maybe pushing away NATO.
Can I go, Rebecca Sinderbrand, to you on this website too? Because there's nothing really on it about immigration either. Domenico Montanaro said nothing about the Affordable Care Act except dismantling it, but nothing specific. But there's nothing about the immigration, but there is something about eliminating the Dreamers.
Right. You know, people worked very quickly at the priorities that they put up right away. And we're also very quick to notice many of the pages from the Obama White House that had disappeared, where Trump has not laid out his policy on those issues. And so for the moment, they've evaporated into thin air because the pages have not yet been generated. We're talking about issues like climate change or LGBT rights or many other areas.
Well, forgive me, since you said disappear in thin air, the website has nothing on climate change but vows to eliminate the plan that was eked out in Paris.
Right. That's right. It doesn't have a dedicated climate change page, but it does, of course, make that particular part of his position very clear. It's a matter of setting the tone and setting the priorities. People look at the first issues that have been posted. Clearly, the president has positions on many other issues, but they look at the first issues as a test of his priorities. And as Domenico noted, health care, the Affordable Care Act, not on there, either getting rid of the Affordable Care Act or what will be done to replace it. And, of course, that has been a subject of much discussion here on Capitol Hill. Even many Republicans on the Hill not particularly certain precisely where the president stands on a timeline.
All right. We're going to a break here. And before we do, I want to invite our listeners to join this conversation. What's next for President Trump and the nation? We're talking about the demonstrations, talking about the website, talking about Russia, and a host of other things as this administration begins to get underway. And we do want to hear from you. You can join us on our toll-free number right now at 866-733-6786. That toll-free number again for your calls, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, but feel free to join the program. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. On Friday, President Donald Trump was sworn in as the 45th President of the United States. We are transferring power from Washington, D.C. and giving it back to you, the people, Trump said. And the transition happened as police arrested protesters and as the FBI, CIA, and other law enforcement and intelligence agencies probe into whether money from the Kremlin covertly aided Trump's victory. We've got a panel of journalists with us discussing the latest political news and what is going on with the Trump administration and what is perhaps likely to unfurl. With us from Washington, Domenico Montanaro, who is lead editor for Politics and Digital Audience with NPR, and Rebecca Sinderbrand, who is political editor with the Washington Post. We also have Greg Gordon aboard, investigative reporter for McClatchy News, And Greg Gordon, I want to go back to you for a moment before we go to our callers and emailers and, you know, certainly a lot of people interacting here and wanting to be heard and wanting to ask questions and make comments. But there's a counterintelligence inquiry going on now to determine really the role of Michael Flynn, Trump's national security advisor, with Russian officials. And what do we know?
Well, that's not an area that I've really delved into a lot, except that we know from a Reuters report that Flynn supposedly called the Russian embassy and was looking at trying to discuss some policy matters, or perhaps was trying to do that. So I gather that's part of it.
There were phone calls that he made apparently to Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, right around before New Year's Day, in fact.
Right, which is a little early. That's like 3 weeks before the president elect became the president. So, what was he doing? That's not something that any American is supposed to be doing, and it can get serious really quickly depending upon what your communication was.
Although the counterintelligence agency, it's not very likely that they could move forward with prosecution or with something along those lines. Yeah,
no, unlikely. But it's worth scrutiny.
Let me get some listener comments on here before I go to your phone calls. A listener writes, the press revealed during the election that they should not be trusted for political reporting. Let the press at least give Trump a year to see how he carries it off without poisoning this great country by divisive and false stories. Respond to that, Rebecca Sinderbrand?
Well, I'd say I think that the job of the press is oversight, and I'd say we're proud of the Washington Post, and I know many other news organizations are, of much of the reporting that we did throughout the campaign, and we're going to continue to do that. I'm talking about investigative reporting, such as our reporter David Farenthal looking into the Trump Foundation and other issues, and that's the sort of thing that people should expect to see from reporters. It's if people aren't upset about it, then we're probably not doing our job.
Well, another comment on the press here, and let me go to you, Domenico Montanaro. David writes, Donald Trump utters a falsehood, a megalomaniacal assertion that turns out to be false. What's new? Now you guys are quarreling with him over his lies. You're dancing like little puppets on his strings. All that can come out of it is that Trump can claim the press is hostile to him. Why aren't you talking about his cabinet?
Well, we are talking about his cabinet, too. I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time when it comes to these things. I do think that when the president of the United States and his spokespeople say things that are false, that it's worth the press talking about. I think it's when they say things that are true, it's worth talking about as well. And I think that it's part of our job to be on that line, try to stick to the facts, try to move toward the truth. We do have to be cautious about being distracted by every little thing, but I think we can walk and chew gum.
Well, there was a report that when Trump moved into the White House, he removed a bust of Martin Luther King, which turned out to be untrue. And in fact, there was a retraction on that. But it's that sort of thing that gives a lot of fuel to this kind of concern.
And I want to weigh in on that for a second, because I do think that the difference between the press and some of the others who are seen as partisans is that we admit when we make a mistake and others don't. You know, I think that when that first came out, Zeke Miller, who was the pool reporter at time and was the only reporter able to go into the Oval Office, said he checked a couple times to see if the bust was still there. He didn't see it. So he reported in the pool report that it wasn't there. Some of us, including myself, tweeted out that the bust was out, that Winston Churchill's bust is in. Well, when Zeke Miller turned around and said, actually, no, the bust is still there. Correction on the pool report. We got it wrong. I also corrected it and said, but people looked at that and said, you're fake news. Now we can't trust you. No, there's a difference between doing your job legitimately. You make a mistake, you make a correction, as opposed to someone who's partisan who goes out there and says, aha, this is what you were up to all along, or this is my agenda. That's not the case with us. If the facts tell us something different, then we change what the reporting is and we own up to it.
All right, I'm going to go to listener phone calls. First, a listener writes, the danger of the Trump administration's introduction of alternative facts is that if these so-called facts are reported by any reputable media organizations, many of us will simply cease to believe anything at all coming from those outfits. And let me go to your calls. Let me begin with Nate. Nate, you're on. Morning.
Hi, thanks. Very straightforward. You know, all of these euphemisms are driving me crazy. The word is lying. These are lies. Sean Spicer is a liar. Donald Trump is a liar. And any journalist unwilling to say that because of political ramifications needs to go get a new job because they're not doing theirs. Thank you.
Okay, I'll thank you for that comment and let it stand and go to another caller, and that's Bertha joining us. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I would like to just say that I think that in this current age of false facts and the really savvy way that particularly the right manipulates media and has since the days of Lee Atwater, I want to recommend for those who haven't seen it, the documentary Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story. This has gone on for a very long time, and I think that people who have been in the media for a long time really need to change the way that things are done. I think there's a very high level of courtesy on the part of media. I think there's also a desire not to be seen as partisan. But it no longer works to have Judy Woodruff hand the microphone to Sean Spicer or Kellyanne Conway and have them say their spiel without comment. It doesn't work to have Grover Norquist come on and say Ted Kennedy's responsible for gun growth in America and have it remain unchallenged. It's very troubling when the Republican presidential candidates met with the media about gotcha questions, what they called gotcha questions. Obviously, hard questions need to be asked, but I think that the Republicans on the right have been very savvy about saying what they want to get out there over and over again. And media is going to have to change the way you're going to have to become more challenging.
Let me thank you for those calls, Bertha, and go back to Rebecca Sinterbrand. Would you agree with the essence of what Bertha just expressed here, Rebecca? I mean, a lineage going back to Lee Atwater and the like and what the Republicans have managed to do on this front?
I mean, certainly we have a lot of people out there and people who've been out there for decades who've been making the case that the press is not reliable, and they have very strong political motivations for doing so. Anyone does to discredit anyone who might bring information which you might find inconvenient or might want to dismiss. You know, and the end result of that, of course, is you see that the approval ratings for reporters, for the media just in general, is just down there near Congress. One interesting note, however, you know, they actually recent polls, Gallup polls and others have asked the public, you know, when it comes to Donald Trump versus the press, who in your mind kind of has the edge? Is Donald Trump being more unfair to the press or vice versa? And for whatever reason, at least at this moment, the press has the edge. People want reporters to be holding the president accountable. They don't think that reporters are going too far, just speaking generally. Of course, broadly, if you break down by different partisan inclinations, people feel very differently depending on which way they're oriented. But of course, reporters can't pay attention to opinion polls. They just have to keep sticking to the job, which is to hold people accountable.
Right, let me go to more of your calls, and let's go to Maryland and welcome a caller by the name of Jennifer. Jennifer, join us, please.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I'm somewhat encouraged in that I think the media is doing a much better job now of being challenging. I watched the Meet the Press interview yesterday, and Chuck Todd just kept asking Kellyanne to answer the question, which we all know she doesn't. And as an American who lives in a democracy and would like to continue to live in one, it's a very scary times for me. I'm not prone to hyperbole, but I really feel as though what the Trump administration is doing is just peddling propaganda. And when Kellyanne Conway actually said, well, he was using alternative facts, I mean, that was frightening. Because it used to be that there was a set of facts that both parties agreed on, and then you would spin them. And we understand the spin from the Democrats and the Republicans. And I'm a registered independent. I voted both ways. And now it's just, well, the facts don't really work for us, so we're just going to lie. And I do believe that it's led from the top and that Donald Trump, unfortunately, is not a truthful person. And I think he sent out his press secretary to give that ridiculous press, whatever that was, statement. And it's just chilling. as an American, to say, well, is this our country? Because this is not what we do in a democracy. And this is not about just being in power. They were supposed to, you know, ironically, he's using that offensive slogan, which I won't repeat, but we used to all be Americans, and then you divided into your parties, and now it's just in the Republican Party, it's just, you know, so happy to be in power that they've just forgotten who they are. And it's a very scary time for me.
All right, Jennifer, let me thank you for your call and appreciate the calls that are coming in. Also, a tweet's coming in from Io who says, I keep coming back to Voltaire. Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. And here's another caller. Let me go to you. Alan, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. It seems that the Republican Party is moving more and more towards Vladimir Putin with the cabinet picks like Rex Tillerson. There's a $500 billion deal in the works at Exxon. And will Donald Trump profit from that? And will he become a real billionaire if they offer to give him $5 billion as a finder's fee for making that $500 billion transaction happen? I think that maybe the Republican Party should consider renaming themselves from the GOP to the Groupies of Putin because they could keep the same initials.
Go ahead. I thought you were done.
Also, Mike Pence over the weekend condemning women for marching and asking where were their husbands, boyfriends, and fathers. Well, how come they let them allow them to go march? I think women are going to do what they want to do. We're in a different age. A lot of what Mike Pence is preaching sounds a lot like Sharia law, which is against Donald Trump's doctrine. So those are my statements.
All right. I thank you for those statements. Let me go back to Greg Gordon from that first statement that was just made by Alan. And Greg Gordon, News Today, Marco Rubio, who had been somewhat skeptical about the Tillerson nomination, has given his support. I don't know how many Republicans are lining up, but there is Republican skepticism and concern about Russia, especially from people like Senator McCain.
Absolutely. There are some folks who have been in foreign policy oversight for a long time, and they've watched some of the shenanigans that Putin engages in.
I remember Romney said it was the single most important foreign policy issue as it relates with Russia. Yeah.
Yes, he did. We were talking recently with the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, and he was expressing deep concern. He was pointing out that Russia is an economically challenged, to say the least, country, and that it's not the superpower that the Soviet Union was by any stretch, but that Putin has been using to the max, with remarkable effectiveness, all of the resources available to him to try to effect change. And of course, everybody thinks that Putin's real goal here is to resurrect the Soviet Union, turn back the clock if it were, if he could. So I think that this is where Trump is going to run into some real pushback. What's amazing to me in digging into this is the number of Russian connections that the Trump crowd has. And also Ukraine, but and some of those relate to the former pro-Putin president Yanukovych. But the number of folks that are around Trump that have ties to Russia is it's mind-numbing. It's hard to really fathom.
Well, the first energy plan emphasizes shale, oil, natural gas reserves. There's a lot of that in Russia, of course, too, but one thing that struck me, and I wonder if you've been digging into this at all, Greg Gordon, were the statements that came out from Putin and Trump about wanting to advance and increase nuclear armaments. They came out almost in seriatim, very close to each other.
I think less than 24 hours, if I recall. And it was interesting because when Trump made his announcement, Putin quickly, after kind of putting a little tweak out there about what Russia was going to do, and Trump responded that he was going to ramp things up here. Putin quickly tried to dial it down publicly, at least with you know, a little bit of a olive branch or you know, some sort of entreaty to let's not get this out of control here. But you know, the United States is clearly going to be ramping up its nuclear armaments, and part of that really, though, relates to North Korea, I think, and Iran too, but not so much now. But certainly, North Korea is provoking a lot of tension with its ambitions, its nuclear ambitions.
And again, Greg Gordon with us from Washington, is an investigative reporter from McClatchy News. Rebecca Sinderbrand's also with us from the nation's capital, political editor of the Washington Post. We got a response to you, from you, if I may, Rebecca, from a listener comment here about the cabinet appointments. This listener says, I was hopeful that Donald Trump would follow through on his campaign promises to help bring back the great American class, but I'm now skeptical after seeing his appointments of Wall Street sharks, corrupt bankers, foreclosure kings, anti-education advocates, and others who suck the blood of the once great American class.
You know, we saw this very interesting dichotomy on Friday when the president was inaugurated. You had this very, very aggressive speech by some measures that really took to task lawmakers who were present and former presidents who were sitting on the stage for not standing up for the middle class, for working people, for being enthralled to corporate interests. And then behind the scenes, you had the inaugural luncheon inside the Capitol where he was mingling with lawmakers and where, in fact, you actually had, for the first time in our reporter's memory, donors present at that luncheon. And so you have this kind of mix. And the question is kind of which Donald Trump will predominate. When it push comes to shove and he actually has to make these decisions on the policies, what's going to dominate, which is going to come out on top. So far, when it comes to the actual policies, we're seeing kind of a mix. We're seeing a mix of policies that certainly make some of his corporate friends or make some people in corporate America very happy. And on the other hand, you're seeing some, such as today, when he's talking about trade deals, which make them very, very uncomfortable.
He's also talking about, of course, reducing regulations and cutting taxes, which they like. Maybe playing different sides of the street with respect to the GOP, it would seem. By the way, at the CIA on Saturday, President Trump declared himself at war with the media. That was, of course, going to the CIA to talk after calling them Nazis and then meeting with them and essentially saying he had their back, as I alluded to earlier. But here's what Rince Priebus said on Fox News on Sunday.
I'm saying there's an obsession by the media to delegitimize this president. And we are not going to sit around and let it happen. We are going to fight back tooth and nail every day and twice on Sunday.
Okay.
Domenico Montanaro, let me go to you on that. I mean, especially, I'm also looking at a tweet here, which sort of dovetails. Bob says, will NPR news policy change? What factors would be involved? And is this really providing sort of a catalyst toward change? Is it making you a lot more nervous?
No. I mean, we don't need to change our policies. We stick to the foundational principles of journalism.
Yeah, but what about that charge that you're delegitimizing the president or trying to delegitimize the president? It certainly seems to go over with many of his supporters, and there are many out there who feel that the press is at fault.
And that's fine. I think that it's our job to stick to good journalism, to challenge the president when it's necessary, to challenge the facts when the facts are off, and to try to maintain that kind of relationship with our audience to make sure that they're well-informed about what's actually happening here. Certainly, we don't want to have and it makes us wary when you have a president certainly going out and his staffers saying that they want to declare war on the media. But then meanwhile, a week ago or so when Trump had his first press conference, he was praising the media for not all taking up the Russian dossier story. So you never know quite where this is going as far as the adversarial relationship with the media. I do think it's incumbent on us, and I have seen a change in this campaign among some in the press, to make sure that when the facts are off, that they're pointed out directly and immediately. I mean, it's one reason why we've had such a strong fact-checking effort here. We started our annotations where just the Trump inauguration, for example, you can go to our website and see Trump's speech annotated. And when facts were off, we included that. We did that for President Obama, by the way, as well, for the Trump supporters who are listening. And we do try to make sure that we're balanced on that. We don't have an agenda to delegitimize a president. That's not our goal. That may be what the White House sees it as the goal. But holding a White House to the facts is what we're doing as a service for the American people.
Well, you mentioned the dossier. And can I get a quick response, Greg Gordon, from you on a question from a listener named Daniel, who says, does anyone in the press care to follow up on the issues raised in the dossier to validate or invalidate them?
Oh, yes. Everybody's chasing this. Everybody, right, Rebecca? you know, everybody's trying to nail it down. But, you know, the Russians are pretty good at covering their tracks. And I'm not saying that, but with that statement, I'm not suggesting that it's really all true. But I'm suggesting we've heard enough and seen enough to suggest that there is some veracity to this document. But nailing that down and proving it is an extremely difficult task.
That's the mountain to climb, indeed. And I just want to remind listeners, you're listening to Forum. We're talking with Greg Gordon and Domenico Montanaro and Rebecca Cinderbrand. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support this radio station, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me go to more of your calls. Let me bring in more callers here who have been waiting patiently. You go to Patrick up in Mendocino. Morning.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'd like to draw an analogy between the ratings of the press and the ratings of the Affordable Care Act that benefits conservatives. And that is that when we say the press has really low ratings, and your commenter a little while ago said when the interviewer hands the microphone to someone and lets them go ahead, I want them to go further than they did. I want them to attack that person. And so if they have an unfavorable rating, some people think they didn't go far enough. The Affordable Care Act had unfavorable ratings, and a big part of those unfavorable ratings were because people wanted single-payer health care. And so this bad vibe towards these institutions is partially for a reason that benefits the conservatives. And that's my comment.
All right. I thank you for that statement. And let me go back, if I may, to Rebecca Cinderbrand, who's political editor of The Washington Post. I'm looking at a question here from Vince, Rebecca. He says, what's the path forward for Democrats, given the impossibility of maintaining congressional power due to Republican gerrymandering? You mentioned the midterm elections being a test, but I think that's unfair, given how impossibly steep this uphill battle is for Democrats. What's left for them to do against the Trump presidency?
Right. Well, you know, we're talking potentially, of course, about a very long road back. That's a road that begins at the state level. Lots of Democrats waking up to the fact that without control of state houses, without the ability to affect the drawing of the district lines, it may be a long time until they return to the majority. And certainly in the near term, it's very difficult to see a path back. One kind of curious thing from this weekend, and it's worth pointing out, is, of course, the energy that was in the streets with the women's marches marching against Trump. Very little of that seemed to be connected to the Democratic establishment itself. It was very different. And the question becomes whether Democrats can find a way to harness that energy and that passion.
They tried to do it, certainly with Hillary Clinton. And in many ways, there were some serious mistakes made. And I suppose when you think about trying to bring the Bernie Sanders supporters in, trying to bring the African-American voters who would have gone out for Barack Obama, they're going to have to reprogram themselves, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, one of the question of the divisions within the Democratic Party is something that is going to occupy them for some time to come. This is actually a discussion we expected to be having about the Republican Party several months ago.
Ironically,
looking
yeah.
ahead and seeing, yeah. we were seeing, you know, there's going to be a big discussion. There's possibly a civil war within the Republican Party. And instead, it's kind of forced a lot of questions that have been simmering under the surface for Democrats. And so they're working through those questions as we speak.
And we'll get another caller on here. Susan, that's you. Welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. Thank you. I wanted to recommend two books that are about Russia and about Donald Trump. And one of them is called The Red Notice by Bill Broder, B-R-O-W-D-E-R. And the other one is The Making of Donald Trump by David K. Johnston.
We featured the David K. Johnston book. I don't know the Broder book, but you want to comment on these, Greg Gordon? Are you familiar?
I haven't got those books yet, but I guess I better get to the bookstore or get online.
Well, the David K. Johnston book, you know, like I said, we featured it on forum. It's in our archives. It did kick up a good deal of fuss among many people. And also, a caller earlier referred to a quote from Mike Pence regarding the Women's March. The quote the listener referred to was from actually a satirical article and was inaccurate. We want to get those things straightened out here as opposed to alternate facts. Let me get another caller on, and that's Michael. You're on. Morning.
All right. Good morning. Thanks for the important discussion this morning. I really appreciate it. What I'd like to address is why the fairness doctrine in media was overturned in 2010, and I see it as the most divisive division of this country today, is that media no longer portrays both sides of the coin, both sides of the aisle. And we've come up with more blogs than media and more personal opinion than facts.
All right. I appreciate that. We've got very little time left here, but there's a tweet here. Is there anything Trump can do to seriously compromise free speech in the media? How do we prevent this? Domenico or Rebecca, you want to take that in the seconds left here?
I think, again, we just have to be vigilant defenders of fact and make sure that we are keeping truth as the North Star.
Well said. And I thank you, Domenico Montanaro, again, as lead editor for politics and digital audience with NPR, Rebecca Cinderbrand, political editor with The Washington Post, and Greg Gordon, investigative reporter of the McClatchy News. I thank them one and all. And thank you, our listeners. We would not be here without you, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Another hour coming up. We're going to talk about sports and political activism with Harry Edwards and with Danielle Slayton, who will also be joining us briefly. Stay tuned for that. And thank you for this. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.